Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us today on the show. We open up the show the first half hour on a listener reaction. We did not like my take on the NCAA wrestling semifinals. I said it didn't grow the sport, and Jim didn't like it. And I understand where Jim's coming from. He's a diehard. He knows more about it than anybody. I got it. But just diehards don't grow the sport. Okay? Growing the sport is getting other people interested in it. Okay? That's my point, and I talk about that with every sport. Now, the part of the email I didn't like was like my prejudice against wrestling is coming out or something like that. It's like, no. I talk about this with every sport. How do you grow it? Right? I love baseball, but I don't like shifts. I don't like launch angles. I don't like the fact that the ball's only in play 8 minutes. How often have I talked about that? I don't like clutch and grab. I don't like flopping in basketball. Okay. I want action. I want to see point. I don't want to see games in the 40s and 50s. Games in the 70s are more appealing to grow the game. Football games in the upper 20s and in the 30s, more appealing to growing the game. I was talking about growing the sport of wrestling. That's a positive conversation. That's somebody trying to promote the sport, trying to come up with solutions to take 625,000 viewers, which is, it's all right, right? And getting it to a million. That's what I'm talking about. I hope Jim understands that. That would, again, the semifinals and the finals a year ago had some dynamic moments in it. The semifinals in Pittsburgh this time did not. Just because the Penn State guys were winning, okay, that's great. The finals, same thing in the finals. Well, again, Bo Nickel had the ability to kind of get some juices flowing in the arena. You know, that's what you want. You want the average fan out there to go, oh, yeah, boy, that looks fun. Wow, I like that, boy. There's some action in there, some defensive. Wow, okay. I think I'm going to watch more. That's what I'm talking about. That's not a prejudice against anything. And also, you try to talk realistically about these things. When I'm talking about athletes being paid and so forth, I'm trying to give you the domino of what could happen. Any other show out there doing it? Or are they just on there fooling around all the time? All right, let's get to our play-by-play call of the day. Dwayne Wade for the final time in his career at home.
Wade, another three. Got it to go off the glass and in. Oh, my. How about that one? That's what you call living right.
Dwayne Wade. Going into retirement, says he doesn't really know what to do. I don't blame him. He's done this his entire life. He loves playing. But he also knows it's time. Now, three guys who are not close to retirement. Allen Robinson of the Chicago Bears, Adrian Amos from the Green Bay Packers, and Donovan Smith from the Tampa Bay Bucks, all recently signing either free agent or long-term contracts. We'll be in the Hub Friday, 4:30, free event. And Mike Poorman is the one that put it together, and he'll lead the discussion. Mike, welcome. Great to have you with us.
I'm great, Steve. Thanks for having me. To be on the same airways with you and Hoops, I have a great Dick Weiss story, if you have time to
please,
hear it.
Please.
Well, you, I'm sure you were probably there in 1982 when Penn State played in Chestnut Hill and it beat Boston College in a major thrashing. The parking lot was on campus because the stadium was on campus.
Oh, yeah.
I was covering it for the Collegian, and the rental car got stuck.
Oh.
and I couldn't get out. And Dick Weiss came to the rescue, took the photographer from the Collegian and I to a hotel, put us up, the next day drove us back to the parking lot so that we could drive to the airport to fly back to State College. I mean, what a guy, huh?
Absolutely. Remember that. BC took the ball first, drove 85 yards. Doug Flutie hit Scott Nieselick with a touchdown.
I knew you would know that. I knew you would know something like that.
Penn State then went on to win the game 52-17. And I've always referred to it as the, quote, perfect balance game. Penn State had 618 yards in total offense, 309 passing and 309 receiving.
I walked into that. You probably remember it was third and four in the second quarter.
I'm not going to go that far. I could make something up and really impress people, but I'll freely admit I will have made it up. The other parts are factual. So
that's a terrific game. As a sidebar to that, we flew up on a Thursday night, went to practice because the gates were open, and it was Boston College back then. Yeah. And the photographer has her camera. We're sitting in the stands. Jack McNeil stops practice, walks over to the bleachers, and he goes, "What are you doing here? Where are you from?" She goes, "Well, we're from Penn State." So he marched us out, stopped practice, marched us out the gate, and threw us out of practice. It was a great trip.
Memories. Memories, Jack Bicknell. All right. You have something really special coming up on Friday. You were able to get Adrian Amos, now with the Packers, Allen Robinson now with the Bears, and Donovan Smith with the Bucks. All three within the past year have signed bigger contracts. But you have them all together. What do you want to accomplish with this on Friday?
Great question. I would like to have them share their stories as not just football players, but as labor, as what it's like to work in the NFL, what the idea is, and you make a great point, is Don just signed an extension. Allen was a free agent. Same with Adrian. What they go through, what is the business, the title is the business of football from a player's perspective, what their thoughts are, issues like the Colin Kaepernick, what the issues are, what they think of playing through injuries. What is their role? And these are, you know them very well. What is their role as young African-American role models making an impact? And they all do in a really neat way, is making an impact in the community. So this is not an X and O's thing. This is really a life kind of thing. And these guys have done well for themselves on and off the field, and they've given back to the community. And I think it would be neat to hear their stories.
And obviously we're involved in the College of Communications. What about the role of dealing with the media and how they have changed maybe as a pro dealing with the media as opposed to how they handled the media when they were here at Penn State?
I just wrote that down. That's one of my new questions. That is terrific. And the role of social media, Donovan is just all over social media. I mean, he's an engaging guy in person, but he has an outsized personality on social media, and I think he's an important part of that Tampa Bay team in the community. I mean, he has an autism walk coming up, but
April 27th, as a matter of fact, we just had him on the show.
Very good. So I should. What other questions do I need to ask here, Steve? This is good.
What other questions do you need to ask them? I would ask them about dealing financially with new contracts and being careful with their money, and how do they want to handle that money moving forward, because there are going to be people knowing that they have money and financial advisors that know they have money, and they want to make sure they're not one of those stories later on in life where they say, oh, that poor guy, he squandered all of it. How about handling that part, because this is more money than any of them have ever had to handle before?
That's a great point. I mean, I think you were making a reference to that 30 for 30 a couple years ago, where 80-90% end up their careers with no money in the bank. I think it's a credit to these guys, and you know the way the contracts work is together, the three of them have over $70 million in guaranteed money. And
yes,
guaranteed is really, you know, that's the literally the coin of the realm, especially in the NFL. So I think it bespeaks to them that they've reached that point and that they are set. Now what are they going to do with that?
Next question I would ask them would be this. Michael Robinson told me a story about he and Jordan Hill when they were with the Seattle Seahawks. Pete Carroll had called a meeting, and Mike goes into the meeting. I think the meeting was set for 4 o'clock, and Mike walks in at 3:45, and there's only one other person sitting in the room. That was Jordan Hill, the two Penn Staters, because Joe Paterno expected you to be 15 minutes early. So what did they learn from Penn State that now when they go to the NFL, they can tell it was a different experience compared to other people, and why?
That's a great point. You know, and what's really been neat is, and there's the flip side of this, is that I wrote a piece last week about this and reached out to O'Brien and reached out to Tommy Bradley, who was their head coach for a couple games.
Mm-hmm.
And the affection that and respect that those two guys have, not only what they've accomplished in the NFL. I mean, Bill said rightly so that Donovan is one of the best left tackles in the business, but what they meant to Penn State are really a challenging time. And I think it was really neat of both of those guys, who at one point were head coaches at Penn State, have that respect, not just for what they've accomplished as pros, but what kind of people they were when they were at Penn State under really, really challenging circumstances under two very different, four different head coaches. So
right.
I think that's important, too.
And I think if you're asking me what else I would ask them, what's their connection with Penn State today and how do they view the program today?
That's a good one. That's a good one. It's and as you know, it's a time of transition. And for me, this is you know these guys. So their connection to Penn State in some ways is through the media, through the classroom, through broadcasters like you. So, you know, you look at how that has evolved too, as far as how they feel connected. I mean, how this all came together is I'm not a big public tweeter, but I tweeted out when Don got his contract with the guaranteed money. I was really happy for him. And I said, come back to guy teach this class about the sports industry. And I had Don in class. He said, come back and tell us your story. And he goes, okay, I will. And then Alan, who I had in class, he comes back. He goes, I'm in too. I'm coming. And then they tweet out, Adrian, you're coming along too. So it was, you know, the interesting how that interaction comes and that connection stays, and, you know, the power of social media, but also the power of those Penn State ties. I think that's pretty neat.
In the end, what do you want your students to get out of this?
I want them to get the truth. I want them to hear from what these guys have experienced, what they think, the first person of what they think about labor, about money, about taking a stand on social issues, from people that literally, you know, your students, my students, that these guys were sitting in those same, very same chairs.
Oh, sure.
6-7 years ago. And I think that power of hearing it from people that hopefully the students can still relate to, of what that message is directly from them. And these guys will be honest and have, I believe, a great deal of candor. They welcome this opportunity to share their story. So I think from that sense, as an obligation in the classroom, to not only tell them the overall story, the overarching story that's out there, but really hear it from the front lines. And these guys are, you know, Donovan's literally on the front line.
They also have, they're also at a stage, all with new contracts, as you mentioned, but at some point they have to think about a post-football life. So have they thought about a post-football life? If so, what might it be? And what role, if any, did Penn State play in them thinking about a post-football life?
You know what? I think you're going to be the co-host here, Steve.
I'm just saying that's what I'd ask them. I mean, I just make this stuff up as I go. Who knows if it's any good?
But it's good stuff, you know, and it's their, how they're moving forward with their life. It's neat to see. Adrian has started his own online blog and website. So he's, and you remember him, he was an excellent player, but kind of a shy guy.
Very shy
right?
guy. Yep.
Yeah, so to see this transformation is pretty exciting to see. And I think you're right. It goes back to their Penn State roots, but I think it's a really good question.
But you know what? But guys evolve, all right? And I'll give you a good example. Kurt Warner, when he was here, the great Kurt Warner, finally got a chance to talk with the media his sophomore year in 1980. And he'd give you one sentence, two sentence answers. In 1982, his senior year, he was talking in paragraphs. So, I mean, everybody grows at their own different rate. So, I mean, that's something that's completely different. Mike, what does it take on your part to try and bring in as many different and what you would perceive to be as interesting topics as possible to keep the students engaged?
You mean with the panel on Friday?
Not just with the panel, but other things that you've done, because you've tried to do other things along the way. What's the challenge of trying to do something like that because you're looking for ways to keep the students engaged and give them a different viewpoint?
Great question. And I know you look at those things in the classroom. Super Bowl week. Rich Russo, who you know is the lead director for Fox, has done the Buck Aikman team for years. I like the kid Rich. He still holds, and it's getting close, but he still holds the all-time record for Penn State goals in a lacrosse game by a male, which is 10. Yeah. So the week of the Super Bowl, Rich has done directed a bunch of Super Bowls. So it's very apt to have him come in that week, come in by Skype, live and say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. Look for this, look for that. And this year we got really lucky. It was his game that was the Saints no call.
Right.
So we showed the no call, and then he talked about what their responsibilities were and how they covered it, what the league expected, what happened as the director in that booth, what they talked about with Aikman and Buck. So really making it, in that sense, a real-time classroom, is that there's the play on a Sunday, and there's the director, and I always love this, it's a Penn State guy, there's the director on Tuesday morning who just directed the shot we just saw on the big screen. I think keeping it current, keeping it relevant, and trying to use people who, I used this before, but who are on the front line, who certainly have that insight in a lot of ways that I don't.
One final question, Mike, and that deals off topic, and that was actually with the blue-white game coming up on Saturday. When you look at the blue-white game, let's just especially like the first quarter and a half in particular, what interests you? What are you looking for?
You mean this specific game
yes.
or overall?
Yes,
I want to see how they use Hamler. I want to see how Wade is as a full-time guy in there. If Tony's a full-time guy in there, I want to see, and full-time may only be a quarter and a half, but I think for that offense, it's integral to really get Hamler involved. So I'm not sure how much they're really going to put on tape, but those are a couple things that I'm looking for that I'm really interested in.
Mike, it's an absolute pleasure. Good luck. One more time, location on this on Friday will be, and what time?
The Hub Auditorium, on the first floor of the Hub, 4:30 p.m. It's free. Everyone's invited to attend. No ticket necessary, and it'll be about an hour.
Terrific. Mike, thanks so much. Best of luck with this on Friday.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Steve. Appreciate your support.
All right, Mike Poorman. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, let's get to actually a little soccer for a moment. That is because the UEFA Champions League is taking place. These are the big semifinals. What Liverpool won yesterday, I believe, Sean. Won 2-0, I believe. So the pool moved on. Right now...
And Tottenham yesterday won 1-0 over Man City in the other matchup.
Meanwhile, Barcelona leads Man U 1-0, 67 minutes in. And... Juventus and is it Ajax?
Ajax.
Ajax. From with the Netherlands, I believe.
That is correct.
1-1. That's taking place in Amsterdam. That's 1-1, 72 minutes in. There was a great article in Sports Illustrated about Eddie Hamel from Ajax.
Last time we had Tony Knopp on the show, he was waxing poetic about Ajax and their Cinderella story that they're currently writing.
Well, Eddie Hamel had been a brilliant American player for Ajax in the late 20s and 30s and ended up at Auschwitz. It's an incredible story in SI.
For nearly 100 years, Purdy Insurance has been your locally owned, family-operated source for insurance products. With a staff of over 20 and partnerships with some of the industry's most trusted companies, Purdy has the experience and resources to get the job done. Whether you need personal, home, and auto, or complex business insurance solutions, Purdy will help you navigate through the process. Call today at 570-286-5855, or better yet, stop in their Sunbury office to see what Purdy Insurance can do for you.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Now, we talked many times about if you use something properly, it can be a great asset to you. Analytics happens to be one of them. I mean, for example, let's take something as simple as a laptop. A laptop can be an incredible tool. I'm sitting there Sunday and I'm putting together my blue-white game chart and things like that. I mean, the number of charts I have on here, I've got basketball charts, football charts, I've got lacrosse charts, baseball charts, wrestling charts. Charts all over the place. But that's how I prepare and I use the laptop. Now, is the laptop a perfect tool? No, there are certain dark areas on the web that you can go to using your laptop, which means at that point it's not useful. So, if you use something right, anything right, something can be used wrong and something can be used right. Well, for the vast majority, of people who have laptops are using it right. Analytics is the same way as a tool. Great article by Jason Stark in The Athletic. I know most of you probably don't subscribe to The Athletic, but I can talk about it because I do, and it gives me some great long-form sports writing, and they have a great lineup of writers. And Jason's article today is about our major league managers becoming obsolete. And it's interesting because I've asked so many coaches, from James Franklin, Patrick Chambers, to Russ Rose, the baseball coach Rob Cooper, the softball coach Amanda Lahotek. I've asked all of them across the board, Erica Dombach, about do you use analytics? Now, I wouldn't ask a Cale Sanderson that because that doesn't enter into this. You know, analytics don't enter into wrestling, but they do enter into other sports. You know, how do you construct a lineup? How do you, what's the best combination of individuals out there? Analytics can even tell you who works the best together and who doesn't. So those are useful tools. Well, it seems that baseball, where analytics is the greatest influence, or at least the most apparent one, when it comes to how the numbers affect how you handle the game. So Jason Stark writes an article. He starts out, and he says, a longtime front office man sat in his team's dugout one day last season, eyeing the dugout across the field. The topic was the two men who would manage the baseball game to be played that night. Our guy, he said, is a manager. He paused and said, and their guy is a middle manager. That's how he started the article. And this is about how analytics have changed the game. Bruce Bochy, of course, who's won 3 World Series championships in his career, and he's managing his final season, said, quote, the game has changed. And he says it's driven a lot by front office people and by all the information that's given to the manager. The manager, he's not the one who's driving the bus as much as he used to be. Now, obviously, there's no doubt with Bruce Bochy who's driving the bus. He is. And he's put together a great run. You know, he's won 1,930 games in 25 years. Terry Francona's won 1,581. Clint Hurdle, 1,205. Joe Maddon, 1,171. Ned Yost, 1,146. Back in 2009, there were 4 managers that had managed for 20 seasons or better. Now there's just 1, Bochy. 10 to 19 seasons. Well, there were 5 in 2009. There are 7 now. But less than 5 seasons of managerial experience. There were 11 in 2009. There are 20 in 2019. Obviously, there are certain managers where there's no doubt they are in control. And then there are others that don't. So here's a quote that Jason Stark says really stuck with him last summer. When a guy is sitting in that manager's office with the credibility of a Mike Socha or a Buck Showalter, the executive said, I think GMs and front office guys are much less inclined to go down there and say, this is how we'd like to run the game. But you notice there are 20 managers with under 5 years of experience. Because that is where baseball is heading. So he quotes Ned Yost in here, brought the Royals to the World Series twice. They won once. And I think there's no doubt that when you watch the Royals, Ned Yost is in charge. So here's the quote Rios said. He was asked about tilting in the direction where the front office and the GM is dictating lineups and so forth. Yost said, quote, I can't speak to that. Honestly, I have my suspicions that it is true elsewhere, but it doesn't happen with us. Dayton Moore, he's the GM of the Royals, and I have been together longer than any manager-GM combination in the game. Do we talk about things? Yes. But does he or does our analytics department ever express anything like that? They don't. They don't tell us how to manage the game. They just don't. Terry Francona started out with the Phillies, won 2 World Series with the Red Sox, and now is the Indians as a perennial division contender. His quote, they would never do that, ever. In my opinion, team president Chris Antonetti could ask me anything he wants, but that doesn't necessarily mean he would. We're aligned. And when there's an issue, our first reaction is probably to protect each other. I can't tell you how many times when something is going haywire, and it does, usually about the second sentence is, okay, how do we make it better? It's not, boy, you screwed up. It's how do we make it better? But they're in their seventh season together. That helps. But there are a lot of other managers now in the game that are having life dictated to them by analytics in the front office. I've always used the example here, and again, I'm announcing in the minor leagues, State College Spikes. And I remember, and it was a championship season they won. The first base coach for the Cardinals now used to be the manager here in State College. And I remember, it's Ollie Marmol. And I remember saying to Ollie one day, they gave us a lineup, and they had a player named Reyes. Now, Reyes played second base, shortstop, sometimes maybe a little third base, but mostly second base. In the traditional sense, Reyes was going to be a number one, number two hitter. Or if you didn't want to do that, you'd make him the number nine hitter and act like he's a second leadoff guy. So one day, I'm over there, and Ollie gives me the lineup card. And I take the card, and I look at it, and Reyes is hitting sixth. I looked at it with some curiosity. And I said, hey, Ollie, let me ask you something. I said, what's the impetus behind putting Reyes sixth? Because, again, to me, he was the prototypical 1-2-9 guy. But I just wanted to at least know what the thinking was. Maybe because he's hot, they want to move up in the order, whatever. And I got an answer I never expected. He said that the analytics people in St. Louis say that there is tremendous value in the number six hitter, and they want him hitting there. I'll admit the answer took me aback. I never expected that answer. And look, when I ask a question, to be honest with everybody, 9.5 times out of 10, I usually get the answer I expect. That time I didn't. Sat back and went, wow. He said, no. He says that they told us to put him there because according to their analytics, they think he has a chance to have a great impact there because now after going through the power part of the lineup, you're starting over again at six. Okay, that's interesting. I would like to point out that the experiment with Reyes lasted about a week to 10 days and then it slid back in a different direction. Now, the player has to make it work. There's a bottom line to it. The player has to make it work. If they're not working, you go with something else. So that part I want to at least be fair about. But that is the influence, even in the minor leagues, of analytics, where the front office in St. Louis is telling him how to construct his lineup. Would Tony La Russa ever allow that? No. And that's where I go back to State College wins the championship. They won at Tri-City, the Astros affiliate. And in the third and deciding game, it was after they had lost game two. Now the series is tied one apiece, the third and deciding game. And we were sitting at a restaurant, and Ali put out four lineups on napkins. He said, hey, just for the heck of it, and we're just talking. I mean, look, I'm just a sounding board at this point, okay? I want everyone to understand, announcers are sounding boards. James Franklin will say something to me, sounding board. Patrick Chambers will say something to me, sounding board. This was a case where Ollie Marmol's using me as a sounding board. You know, I'm a decision maker on the broadcast. I'm not a decision maker on the games. But sometimes people will just, they either want to vent or they want to bounce something off of you, okay? So he looks at me, he says, what do you think of these four lineups? and looked each one of them. And the fourth one, I picked up the fourth one and said, I'll be honest with you, that's your best offensive lineup right there. And he had two guys playing out of position. But offensively, that was his best lineup. And he looked at me, he said, you know what? And that's the lineup I'm going to go with. He says, it's interesting. You said it was the best offensive lineup. I said, okay. I said, let's take it a step further. Why? He said, because Tony La Russa always believed that when you got to your biggest games, you put your best offensive lineup out there and you save your defensive guys for later in the game to put it away. Now, that's managing. But you have, it's an interesting time. I would like to know from somebody in the Phillies organization what kind of input the Phillies front office happens to have with Gabe Kapler versus how much input Kapler has. Kapler may be in the category of Ned Yost, Terry Francona, Joe Maddon, where, look, there's no doubt he's in control. Or is he, as described in the beginning of the article, one of the middle managers? I think it helps you make decisions, but it really, in my opinion, it cannot be the ultimate decision maker. The human element means so much in everything. I know we're trying to eliminate human elements when it comes to replay. There's too much replay out there. But I think that it's hard to define, but you have to have an instinct about this, and it goes to what I refer to as the feel for the game, where your knowledge in combination with your gut feeling about something allows you to play chess as a player, a coach, or a manager, as opposed to the other side playing checkers. And there are certain coaches that just have it, or managers that have it. Terry Francona, Joe Maddon, they have it. Bill Belichick, whether you like him or not, has it. I think Doug Peterson does too, as a matter of fact. I think James Franklin has it. There's no question Cale Sanderson has it. Russ Rose has it. They have that instinct, that feel for it, that's just a little bit different than the other guy across the way. They prepare you in such a way. They talk strategy in such a way. They have a method in such a way. And, you know, and if there has to be an adjustment along the way, they're the first ones to know what the adjustment should be and why. Doesn't mean it works every single time, but they know why they're doing it. There are other people that, you know, fall into the middle management category, where you're not quite sure what kind of feel they do have for the game. And I've always thought that, you know, and that's where the middle management part comes in. It's interesting how it used to be in football, Johnny Unitas, Bart Starr, they called their own plays. Well, Paul Brown, starting in the 50s, wouldn't let Otto Graham call plays. As smart as Otto Graham was, Paul Brown called all the plays. Now, everybody calls all the plays. On the major league level, you've got people that call the pitches. The catcher doesn't call the pitches. Catcher relays it. And now, after seeing coaches and managers take more of the decision-making away from the players. Now you're finding general managers taking some of the decision-making away from the coaches. It's an interesting transition. I'm not so sure it's the best way to go. I mean, I'd rather have my manager be the one that's down there making decisions, and I'll make personnel decisions. I'm the GM. Hey, what do you need? How can we make it better? Right, look, I'll work on it. Okay, you work on just, you know, you want to do a hit and run? You do a hit and run. That's your bit. You want to put the lineup? Because your knowledge of putting lineups together is better than the guy from Yale. I mean, the only guy we have from Yale in the station sells digital media. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Well, this is 150 years of college football. You know that? 1869. Princeton and Rutgers. I think Rutgers won the game 6-4, I believe. It's the lawn where... Actually, it's where the old... It's actually the spot where the old armory where Rutgers played basketball years ago. The 76 Rutgers team that made it to the Final Four, it's in that old armory, that arena where they played the games, was actually where the first football field was, where they played the game. And in year 150, it's interesting, Dave Revson wrote a book years ago about the 1800s. But it's interesting how some of the same questions that we have now happened back then. And about paying players, about graduation. But what really, where football really took off on the college level was the 1920s. Red Grange, Newt Rockne, bigger stadiums were being built. And you know the odd part about that is, in the late 20s into the early 30s, Penn State de-emphasized football.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.